We're joined now, I believe, by Mahdi Nazim Royer. Are you there, sir?
Hi, how are you, Phil?
Very good, and it's good to be talking to you. You have an important article here. I hope people will read it, globalresearch.ca. The title is The March to War. Fighting ISIL is a smokescreen for U.S. mobilization against Syria and Iran. That was September 26th, and it's featured at Global Research. And Mahdi, you have been right on top of this subject, and it's this matter is almost day to day full of frightening stories and a shifting focus. But one of the focuses now is this situation in an area called Kobani, if I pronounce that right. Could you begin by shedding light on that matter for our listeners?
Okay, well, Kobani, or what you might see on the map is Ain al-Arab, which is the Arabic name for it. Kobani is the Kurdish name for it. And that's because it's predominantly Kurdish. But I'd like to emphasize that Kobani is not just Kurdish. There's Turkmen, Assyrians, Armenians, and Arabs there as well. But the majority are Kurds, and we call it Kobani because of them. And because of the fact that that area now is run by an autonomous Syrian Kurd government, it's not separatist, it's autonomous. It has three governorates or districts that they themselves have formed. Kobani is the central one, so it's the one that's connecting the western district and the eastern district of this autonomous Kurdish area, which is run by the people's defense units or committees, and as well as the Syrian Kurd government, autonomous government, which is combined, which is two factions that have been combined. One of them is the Kurdish Democratic Union
so
Party,
it's a,
I believe.
A unity government, or a force.
It's a unity government, but part of it is also tied to the Kurdistan regional government in Iraq, which, you know, is trying to push these guys to be more aligned towards the United States. Mm-hmm. Anyways, the bombing of the Ain al-Arab, according to Syrian Kurd officials from this autonomous region, so I'm paraphrasing them, has been instigated on the request of Turkey. Turkey's made the request. They're saying that this attack is because Ankara and President Erdogan have requested that from the United States and from ISIL or ISIS, whatever you want to call it, the Islamic State, Dola Islamiyah, to attack them, okay? Mm-hmm. At the same time that these attacks have been going on, the Ankara has been negotiating for them to surrender to Turkey's demands, give concessions, and to basically fight against the government in Damascus. So because these Kurds, these are bad Kurds in the books of Washington, Washington is not openly saying this, or in the book of the books of Ankara, they're bad Kurds. Unlike the Kurds, the Kurdish government, of course, running the Kurdistan regional government, the Barzani clan, CIA / Mossad associates, agents, unlike them, these are independent Kurds, okay? And they're trying to get them to surrender and even to join forces with the insurgency in Syria, such as the so-called Free Syrian Army, al-Nusra, to fight the government in Damascus. So this is what the bombing campaign's about. And in fact, the U.S. State Department, a few days ago, about a week ago, when it was being questioned, it was last week, when they were being, one reporter said, I noticed that there's almost no bombings there, you know. And the reply of Ms. Psaki, the U.S. spokeswoman, State Department spokeswoman, was that this is not a strategic issue for the United States.
Yeah.
You know, they claimed that...
Guilty of being the wrong Kurd.
Yeah, they say this is not a strategic issue for us, you know. And the Kurds themselves, the Syrian Kurds, are saying... Your airstrikes, they're illegal, by the way. They shouldn't be happening. But anyways, regardless of that, they're saying that the airstrikes are absolutely doing nothing. They've asked for arms. That's what they've been asking for, is arms.
Well, is it true that Kurds have asked for also for the to ability or right to enter into the area to help their fellow Kurds from the Turkish side of the border?
Yes, but all of a sudden, Turkey, which is claiming that it can't control the Syrian-Turkish border and let foreign fighters cross, is saying this is so difficult, we can't do it. All of a sudden, it's able to prevent fellow ethnic Kurds from Turkey from entering to help the Syrian Kurds. Not just Syrian Kurds, there's Arabs there and Turkmen. These are Syrians, anyways, from crossing over to help them. You know, so I've listened to this. I've watched a lot of footage. I've watched the protests there. I mean, I understand a bit of Kurdish. Their dialect in Syria is not the same dialect. The dialect was a little hard for me to pick up on, but I heard what they were saying to Turkish military officials and to the the guards, and what they were saying about how they wanted to fight, and they were saying that these people are our blood, like we'll never let them fall. But what's happening on another dimension to this is that they want some. The United States would not feel bad if there was a bloodbath there, because it and the Turkish government would use this just like they used Srebrenica in Bosnia as a pretext for ground troops. You know, the ground troops are something. They're saying we're not going to send ground troops. There's mixed messages. Mr. Obama says we're not going to send ground troops, but all his generals in the Pentagon are saying we need ground troops. Okay, and the facts are, for airstrikes, you do need, at least at the very minimum, reconnaissance and special forces on the ground.
I mean, so I don't know who they think they're kidding.
But anyways, they want to send people on the ground. So at one level is they're trying to get these Kurds to surrender, but at the same time, they also want some sort of humanitarian disaster so they can create their buffer zone, and one of Turkey's key demands for creating the buffer zone and getting involved is a no-fly zone, which we're seeing. Mission creep here. You know?
Oh, absolutely.
You know, the United States, it's no coincidence that days before the airstrike, John Kerry said the Syrians have violated they've used chemical weapons, although the components they used are not considered chemical weapons.
They're the only state in the region that actually complied with the international statutes on chemical weapons. Everybody else in the neighborhood's holding on to theirs, but Syria actually cooperated. So, cynical.
Well, when we mean the neighborhood, we mean specifically Israel, and we know Egypt. And the reason why Syria and Egypt both had chemical weapons was
they didn't have nuclear.
Because Israel has nuclear weapons and chemical weapons of mass destruction, and this was the only card they had as a deterrent against Israel. I'm not justifying chemical weapons, but you know, if you're going to be against them, it should be across the board. It shouldn't be double.
Well, that's the deal. It's comprehensive agreements. I noticed that the states that one could have some respect for, I take, for example, Venezuela, said, well, it's quite easy to solve this problem, said President Maduro when he was speaking to the United Nations. He said, there is a sovereign state that is fighting these terrorists, that's Syria, and if you would make a common front with them, they would be happy to finish off the terrorists. But, that's not even on the table.
No, well, it's like I said about the State Department, the same journalist who pointed out there was very little airstrikes also pointed out that for some reason, as soon as the airstrikes have started, ISIL is getting stronger in Syria with every airstrike. Mm-hmm. So what does this say? We can make some correlations here, you know. Logically speaking, airstrikes. Where are these airstrikes hitting, by the way? I've heard from sources in Syria that they're wheat silos, civilian homes, and all of Syria's energy infrastructure has been bombed. They're attacking the Syrian state. They're using ISIL as a cover to attack the Syrian state, to weaken it economically and at the level of infrastructure. And this is part of a U.S. tactic, by the way, destroying infrastructure. Mm-hmm. They did this in Iraq. They're doing this now in Ukraine via...
Yes, it's called they degrade it.
Mercenary.
To use Obama's phrase, they're going to degrade. And they degraded Iraq, and now they're degrading Syria.
They're degrading Syria. Of course they degraded Iraq. Iraq doesn't even have a decent air force.
You hit the magic button. I have to ask you, why don't they, after 11 years of training and mentorship by the greatest power on earth, and everybody saluted each other and said, now you have an army, we're going to go home. I remember that story from Obama. But he didn't have an air force. Why didn't they give him an air force?
They have a residual air force. I mean, it's only an air force that can do surveillance work.
I would not join a residual air force.
Of course, no sovereign army can do anything with this type of... I mean, the planes they basically have are transport planes. You know, they can only pick up. Yeah, it's not a fighting air force at all. They've been supposed to actually get planes for a long time, and the United States hasn't delivered them.
And then you have the issue of bombing. Everybody says, oh, yes, somebody has to bomb. And as you say, yes, bomb. And Iraq does have an army. If they had their own air force, they could bomb and attack. But here they don't have an air force.
No, the United States has actually delayed and obstructed delivery of F-16 aircraft, which were been paid for Baghdad. It's deliberately
the money. You're right. The money's already been put up.
The money's been put up, and the Iraqi government complained, saying we need these.
Yes. You know,
they said we of all the times. Why are you dragging your feet on? This is why they made a request for fighter jets from Russia and Belarus.
Yes.
You know, because the United States wasn't delivering anything.
I remember
and no one's trained.
Yeah, I know. Isn't that interesting? No one's trained. speaking of Mahdi Nazimroya, globalresearch.ca, and the article, The March to War, Fighting ISIL is a Smokescreen for U.S. Mobilization Against Syria, Iran. And Mahdi, I have to remind our listeners that we spoke to you when you had risked your life, and thanks to Global Research and you, we learned so much about the horrific events of Libya, where NATO destroyed that government after establishing a, quote, no-fly zone. And at that time, during those interviews, the subject of Syria came up because there were odd little murmurs coming out of Paris and London and Washington with saying, Syria is next. Do you want to revisit those thoughts? And I know it's in your article.
Well, going after Syria has been something that they wanted to do in the long term. It is long-term strategy. You know, after the Cold War ended, Paul Wolfowitz said that we have to regime change in countries, Libya, Iraq, Syria. He said that these are countries aligned to the Soviet Union before the next superpower rises. He said that Richard Pearl, in fact, on TV Ontario, of all places, said that we're going to attack Iraq, Syria, Iran, Lebanon. He gave a list.
Who created that beautiful phrase? People say, let's go to Damascus, but real men go to Tehran.
This phrase comes from the Bush 2 administration, and specifically the neocons. You know, after they destroyed Iraq. By the way, the war against Iraq in 2003, I mean, Iraq was already a depleted country. After years and years of illegal
and no-fly zones on both north and south.
Exactly. Illegal no-fly zones that were established by the U.S., Britain, and France. Illegal. Mm-hmm. No mandate for them and against international law. Continuous bombardment of the country on top of the sanctions regime. So Iraq was weakened, and they invaded the country. And after this, they were... They were discussing, should we go after Iran right away? Should we go after Syria? Of course, I'll be very frank. Iran was the ultimate objective in the region.
Yeah.
But Syria is a stepping stone. It's just like Iraq is a stepping stone towards regime change in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And they haven't given that up. Right now, they're funding an organization, an opposition group, that has the ultimate goal of regime change in Iran. And this actually...
MKO.
MKO or MEK.
MEK, pardon me, MEK. KO
no,
is
no,
probably...
No, it's both. Why? It's both. You can use either one. They have an ultimate goal of regime change in Tehran. They have militias, tanks, armored personnel trained... and they've been involved with espionage. In fact, we know that a lot of the information... false information.
Well, they were there under Saddam and now under the U.S., and the Iraqi government isn't allowed to touch them.
No, the Iraqi government wasn't, even when they got sovereignty over the area. And in fact, this was one of the reasons the U.S. was angry at Maliki, was because he wanted to get rid of them in Iraq.
Well, I got to thank you, by the way. You've made a list of the large delegates from the delegations of the U.S., France, Spain, Canada, and Albania were present for the to hear a speech by the great leader of that organization, which was at one time internationally regarded as terrorist, but the United States has now removed it from the terrorist. Why do we even, anybody bother talking about that word terror when the U.S. can be so cynical and call a guy a terrorist on Monday and call him not a terrorist on Tuesday?
Well, it's clear that terrorism, whoever, the correlation with labeling someone a terrorist is tied to foreign policy objectives.
I hope people go to this article and see all the names. My goodness, Newt Gingrich and, of course, the...
Kim Campbell from Canada.
She must have wondered when they told her she was going what this is all about.
They get paid to
and,
go.
And, you know, you've probably seen the video.
$1.
It's a cynical... I mean, it's such a show. They're sitting there like students, all these allegedly powerful people, and she's giving the lecture about how they got to knock over the government of Damascus.
And, I mean, these people are paid to go. They're from across the political spectrum. There was several former members of parliament from Canada that went. The Canadian delegation was big. I emphasized more on the U.S. delegation. The reason why there was a large Albanian delegation is because a lot of these MEK or MKO militia members are now going to Albania, where they're being trained. And, you know, they've been moved from Iraq to Albania. So that's why there was a large Albanian delegation. There was a large delegation for France because this event and their Politburo is in France. There was also many people from Spain. Former socialist prime minister was there with his wife. I mean,
by the way, that gives us an opportunity to, and I know you think about these matters, that there is a people speak of these people with their blood-curdling language and have their big plans to knock over one government, number one, government number two, etc. And we often hear neocon, etc. But I can't see a difference between Mr. Obama, Mr. Clinton, Hillary Clinton, and how am I supposed to make a distinction between those people?
Well, I think we should listen to these people, the people in the U.S. foreign policy elite when they speak. Listen to them describe themselves. You might say they're liars, you might not, but they all say the U.S. foreign policy is part of a continuum. Doesn't matter if a Democrat is in or a Republican. There's already a system at play that has a life of its own, and they have to cater to that system and continue policies. That's why every single American president since George Herbert Bush Senior, has been bombing Iraq. You know, he bombed Iraq, Clinton bombed Iraq, then Bush too, George W. Bush Jr. bombed Iraq.
A rite of passage.
Now, Obama.
A rite of passage for an American president. Bomb somebody.
They've been bombing Iraq since I was a kid, you know. it's decades of bombardment.
When you mentioned, by the way, Winston Churchill, wasn't he the first one to even, during the First World War to bomb Iraq?
Oh, yeah. The British are the first to use chemical weapons. I mean, they used chemical weapons in Iraq against the Kurds and the Arabs.
But that didn't count. Those were Arabs, right?
No, it didn't count, just like their concentration camps didn't count in South Africa against the Boers and the Zulus. Actually, they used concentration camps not just against the Dutch settlers, but against the Zulus, who originally were aligned against the British, and the apartheid system was actually used as a way of dividing the two in their resistance towards the British. I'm not apologizing for what the Boers did, of course, colonially, but there is also some Machiavellian moves by the British there to divide and conquer by using racial politics. So, I mean...
Oh, the empire politics, I mean, certainly we had our own near... We had a lot of bloodshed during the First World War and during the Boer War, where, you know, the whole idea of loyalty to the throne and the British Empire caused some to want to march and some not to want to march, and so they fought each other in Canada. We're speaking to Mahdi Nazimroya, and by the way, he's the author of The Globalization of NATO. And just lastly, and again, I want to say that I hope people go to globalresearch.ca, read this article. The information dominance really, it seems to me, to be so much in place now, certainly as strongly as it's ever been since World War II or beyond. The ability of the Pentagon, State Department, to set the daily agenda for us all and make us talk about what they want us to talk about. You've told us a lot about Kobani, for example. Our listeners, most of them, never heard most of these facts. But it's very hard to extract any information. I know we have the internet, but you have to be very diligent, don't you?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a free market, let's say, of information now because of the internet. And mm-hmm. the United States is doing everything to destroy that. That's why it's, let me use an analogy or a little tale. You know, in the United States, Russia Today, RT, the news network mm-hmm. from Moscow, based in Moscow, also has a branch in Washington, the Washington Bureau and RT America. They put up ads saying that, listen to us before they shut us down, because they actually think that they might be banned in the United States, just like they did to Press TV. You know, Press TV was taken off all the satellites, mm-hmm. and it was banned, like basically, essentially banned in Britain from yes. being watched, and people had to use the internet. But now, because of this new fight against ISIL, they're mm-hmm. trying to pass very draconian measures where sites can be banned on the internet now and prevented even from being watched. So they want to really monitor the internet, police it, even social media. And this was actually a major theme of the United Nations. This mm-hmm. They said this is an important part of fighting terrorism. And David Cameron, for example, said, we need to go against non-violent, he said the words non-violent, conspiracy theorists. And those are people who believe that, for example, Muslim populations are being targeted, speaking about clash of civilizations. So he said, we need to go after these people, get rid of them from the universities, because mm-hmm. some of them might be professors or students or whatever.
Yes.
And we need to go after them and punish them. So, I mean, even your views now can get you arrested. It's very Orwellian. It's really 1984 is today. It's this Back to the Future
yes.
Type stuff.
The witch hunts never end.
No, actually, we are living in a inquisitorial time. You know,
yes.
there's a post 9/11 Inquisition, and even though it's a lie, we all have to pay lip service to it,
yes.
regardless of it. Like, we have to, even when we know it's not true, we have to conform to it and even argue in the framework of the lies. You know, this is what happened at the UN Security Council.
Yes.
You know, the United States said we're going to fight ISIL and terrorism, but the Russians, the Chinese, the Syrians, and Argentina all retorted. Okay, but very diplomatically, the Syrians were the frankest, but Argentina basically told the United States that you guys, that these terrorists,
that's
were freedom
very
fighters.
Important. People, that's our hemisphere, and Argentina used to always be the bunch of generals who went along, and now they have a real president.
Well, the
and
real
she,
president
she's very
is
sharp.
Saying they might be regime change in Argentina.
Well, that's what she
the
says.
The United States might yeah. want to remove me.
Yeah. Hey, by the way, Evo Morales just got elected by a huge majority.
Yes, he did. I followed that today.
Isn't that a great sign?
It's good to know that an independent, someone who thinks independently of Washington or any other country, has been elected. You know,
yeah.
so independent foreign policies for all.
That's the one that I think France made him land his plane so they could look for Mr. Snow.
Yes, exactly. I mean, you know, or they've tried to ban him from going into Spain.
Yeah.
Many things. They tried to oust him using U.S. aid and even divide Bolivia, into two countries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of the old elites took over some of the departments, the actually gas-rich departments in Bolivia, and they wanted to succeed and become a separate state
mm-hmm.
aligned to Washington.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's also a siege in Latin America, and we shouldn't forget that.
No, indeed, we're going to invite you, please, to come in we're going to be doing fundraising in a couple of weeks, but then we'd like to have you back, because we'd love to focus on this issue that you've brought to light, the Argentine matter and the whole thing, the struggle to try to reassert U.S. authority. We've been speaking to Mahdi Nazimroya. The title of the article is The March to War, Fighting ISIL is a Smokescreen for U.S. Mobilization Against Syria, Iran. That's globalresearch.ca. Mahdi, thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having me.
Okie doke. Bye-bye. And you're listening to CIUT, 89.5 FM, Taylor Report. I mentioned that Richard Williams is going to be coming. He'll be at a different book list on November the 7th. He's going to be speaking at the Black and Caribbean Book Affair on November the 8th at 4 p.m. He's going to be signing his book at the different book list. This is, as I mentioned, the Taylor Report, and I'll remind you that this is October, and this is the month in which the great Native leader Shawnee Tecumseh died, and I would remind you that nobody knows what kind of monument to build to him, where to put the monument, etc. And it, because it would cause us to revisit the War of 1812, etc. But I would just say again for our listeners that he was fighting to establish a territory in the Ohio Valley. His allies were the British, but they had an agreement with him to fight in the Ohio Valley. He spent the year 1813 alongside General Proctor trying to capture forts at Meigs and Stevenson. And eventually, because the British lost control of Lake Erie, the British decided to cross back over into Upper Canada, and they were pursued. He did not fight to defend Canada. He was trying to win liberation for his people in the Ohio Valley. There needs to be a big monument in Ohio to properly place him in history. But he can't be adopted by anybody around here, nor in Washington, as a matter of fact. My favorite adoption of him was that the Americans had a great Civil War general. His name was Sherman, because his father had been chased down the road by Tecumseh. Anyhow, this is the Taylor Report. And, hey, go to CIUT.fm. You can start renewing your membership or taking a new membership right now. And next week we're going to be fundraising, so I know you're looking forward to it. We are too. We'll see you next week.